Welcome to the first podcast of Emmanuel Reads, featuring Rabbi Neil Gilman. Emmanuel Reads is a community learning experience. The entire congregation spends the better part of the year reading one book, studying its meaning and significance. Lectures, panel discussions, and a Shabbaton enhance our discussions. The book selected for our 2007-2008 program is The Sabbath, Its Meaning for Modern Man, written by the preeminent theologian, philosopher, and social activist, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. We are podcasting from the Clow Reading Room at the Stettenheim Library at Temple Emmanuel, New York City. We are privileged tonight to hear Rabbi Neil Gilman lecture on the topic, Are Jews Responsible for the Whole World?
Thank you, Marcia. That's so gracious of you. First of all, it's an honor to be invited to Emmanuel and to see many of my Skirball friends back after a long break, and a particular honor to be introduced by Marcia, who tries to be a student and will undoubtedly continue to be a student with us. I wanted to speak in two or three different ways. Heschel is very complicated. Those of you who have studied Heschel with me know that my own relationship with Heschel was very complicated. And I want to try to do honor to the topic and to take it seriously, which I've tried to do, which I will try to do, and at the same time to near the end, to touch upon some of these complexities that I feel have to be articulated when people discuss the work and heritage of Abraham Joshua Heschel. As you heard, I came to the seminary in 1954. Heschel had been at the seminary from 1946. He was born in 1905 in Warsaw, and stayed in Poland until he was 26, when he left Warsaw to go to Berlin, where he took a PhD in religion at the University of Berlin. He spent the 30s in Germany, until the Nazis sent all Eastern European Jews back to Poland in 1938. And finally, in 1940, shortly before the Nazi invasion of Poland, HUC in Cincinnati rescued him as one of a group of 12 scholars who were saved and brought out of Europe. His family, mother and sisters, were all exterminated. But he got out of Poland shortly before the Nazi invasion of Poland, then made his way to Cincinnati, where he taught at the Hebrew Union College, the Reform Rabbinical School, and then came to New York to join the faculty of Jewish Theological Seminary in 46, and he taught at JTS from 46 till his death in 1972. He died very young. He was 67 years old. When you consider the fact that his colleague, companion, rival, Mordechai Kaplan, died at the age of 103, the fact that Heschel died at 67 is a striking statement about the loss. What would Heschel have accomplished if he had been given another 15, 20, 25 years even? But from 54 until 72, I was at the seminary, and I was a sort of a contemporary of Heschel's. I was a student for the first of those years, many of those years, and then eventually joined the faculty and had a very different kind of relationship with Heschel. When I was dean of the rabbinical school and then teaching, and he was a senior member of the faculty. So from 54 to 72, it's a period of about 18 years, I had the experience of being as close to Heschel as anybody could be. I mean, nobody was really very close to him. Yes, some were, but I sort of saw him from day to day. I want to suggest that those of you who are interested in the Heschel in America years, from 40 till his death, the second volume of the biography of Heschel by Edward Kaplan has now been published and is available. So we now have the two-volume biography. Volume takes you up to 1940 when he left Europe, the second volume from 40 till his death in 72. It was just published this year. It's available. You can get it. Westside Judaica has it. Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Edward Kaplan is a professor at Brandeis. And in relation to today's topic, he is the son of a very prominent social activist by the name of Kivi Kaplan. Some of you who go back to that generation, to the 40s and the 50s, and the I don't want to date you, but those an older generation of Jewish social activists in the city of New York might have heard of the name Kivi Kaplan, Akiva Kaplan. Kivi Kaplan is Ed Kaplan's father, was Ed Kaplan's father. Ed Kaplan is a professor of French Romance languages at Brandeis, and he got to know Heschel very closely through his father, and he has now written the two-volume biography. The first volume of the European years, the second volume of the New York years. So if you really want to have a sense of Heschel sort of day-to-day in America, Kaplan has reconstructed that brilliantly. I have reservations about the book on other grounds, but it is a detailed chronicle of the evolution of the Heschel, the Heschel who became the icon of American liberal American Jewry in the years from 40 until his death in 72. Now, the topic that I was given today and I understand that this is part of a series on Heschel at Temple Emanuel. The topic reads, Are Jews Responsible for the Whole World? Heschel's Philosophy of Social Responsibility. Heschel's Philosophy of Social Responsibility. And of course, my own field is theology, so I am particularly interested not in this Heschel, but in the other Heschel, the theological Heschel. The Heschel who wrote Man is Not Alone and God in Search of Man and the Sabbath and Passion for Truth and a two-volume study of the Kotzke. But I accept the fact that this is a significant piece of the Heschel story. And I do want to address that. I should say at the beginning that I did not share. I shared Heschel's values. I was a good, solid New York Democrat, social, political, liberal, and remain that to this day. But I was not going to go onto the barricades for any of the causes. And I remember as a student when Heschel rallied the student body about for one cause or another and said, let's march. I sat in the library and studied, and other students marched, and that was fine. I mean, I never felt particularly compelled to picket. Dr. Finkelstein, who was my mentor at the seminary, who was then president of the seminary throughout all of these years, and whose relationship to Heschel, incidentally, was extraordinarily complicated, and good for Ed Kaplan. He's very, very honest about this Kaplan-Finkelstein relationship, which was far from pleasant. But in any case, it's in the book if you want to pursue that. Finkelstein used to say, I saved the world by sitting and studying Torah. He refused to cancel classes. The world could be burning, and everybody else in the city of New York could be picketing, whether it was the Soviet embassy or the South African embassy or the United Nations or for some cause or other. Finkelstein said, anybody who wants to go picket can go picket, but we don't stop learning Torah. We save the world by learning Torah, and those who want to picket can picket, but the rest of us will sit and study. I usually sat and studied. So whereas I shared Heschel's values, I did not necessarily share his techniques. I have to say, I should have said this in the beginning, I have the most god-awful, terrible head cold. And if you hear it, and if I sneeze, you will understand that it's I've taken every medication in the book and nothing seems to have helped. So I have this, and I have water, and I'll see. We'll see how we go. But I want to begin with an anecdote, because the issue is Heschel is known to most people not as a theologian, but as a social and political activist. Right, you know him as the guy who marched with Martin Luther King. You've seen that picture, especially this past weekend, everywhere. Heschel is walking with Martin Luther King from Selma to Montgomery. We know of Heschel, who went to the Vatican and argued with the Pope and the cardinals about the wording of the statement of the Catholic Church on the Jews that was issued after the Vatican II. We know of Heschel, who fought the war in Vietnam bitterly. He did not believe that we should continue to study while the world burned. He thought that we should picket and scream, and he was all over the country. Incidentally, from time to time, he would drop in and teach his classes, but shortly thereafter, he was off in Washington. He was lobbying in Washington or speaking to a rally against the Vietnam War at the Danbury Jail or in Los Angeles or wherever. He spoke at White House conferences on adolescence and youth, at AMA conferences on the patient as a person, on every significant. He created the field, the opposition to the attempt to save Soviet Jewry. He and Elie Wiesel were instrumental at the beginning in bringing the whole issue of Soviet Jewry to our attention. This is the popular Heschel. This is the Heschel who got the headlines, right? So you know all of that. So one year, I decided that since I was a student both of Heschel and Kaplan, and we used to go from Heschel on Monday morning to Kaplan on Tuesday morning, and you know, banter back and forth. They rarely spoke to each other. They used to speak to each other through us. They would criticize it. Heschel would criticize something that Kaplan wrote to us in class, and so the Kaplanians would run to Kaplan and say, you should have heard what Heschel said. And then Kaplan would retort on Tuesday mornings, and we would run back to Heschel and tell Heschel, you should have heard what Kaplan said about you. I decided, they were both dead. This was about 15, 20 years ago. And I announced that I was going to teach a course which I titled Heschel and Kaplan Face to Face. So what I did was took issues, God, peoplehood, prayer, revelation, mitzvah, and I structured a course so where we would take any one of these issues and read what did Heschel have to say about this and what, and I would sort of pit one against the other and sort of try to recreate for my students what we in class felt going from a Heschel class on Monday morning to a Kaplan class on Tuesday morning, where they were basically dealing with similar issues, and we got the rivalry and the polarities and the tension between the two. And I remember distinctly that 6 or 7 weeks into the class, a woman undergraduate put up her hand and said, "Professor Gilman, I find it very interesting that Kaplan is so much more Jewish than Heschel." And I said, "I wouldn't have put it this way, but I would say that whereas Kaplan wanted to save the Jewish people, Heschel wanted to save the world." And I think it's true. Kaplan was interested in saving the world. Who isn't? But Kaplan's energy was focused on trying to create a valid, meaningful, authentic Judaism for a very, very different generation of young Jews who had encountered the social sciences, who had read Freud, who had read the anthropologists, the sociologists, William James, and had gone to college, had had a modern education, were modern secular Jews, and were struggling with, so what in all of this does Judaism have to say to me? That was Kaplan's focus. Generationally, Heschel came along 20 years later. Kaplan's heyday was the 30s. And it was during the 30s that we believed that people left yeshiva to come to JTS because they knew that at JTS they would find an honest attempt to deal with modernity in Jewish terms, which they were not getting at Yeshiva University. And they could still become rabbis, modern American rabbis. And that's why they came. By the time Heschel came to the seminary and established his reputation, the Holocaust was behind us. World War II was behind us. It wasn't the 30s anymore. The issue was not the Americanization of Judaism. The issue was how can anybody believe in anything after World War II? And Heschel was a survivor. Heschel was a European Jew. Heschel had nourished this Yiddish accent till his very last days. And Heschel's job was the revival of Judaism, but it was very clear that at a certain point, Heschel's focus turned from focusing internally to the Jewish world, externally to the issues that were roiling in the big wide world outside of the Jewish community. Why did Heschel make that shift? What led Heschel to change from being a survivor, trying to recapture how one could possibly have faith in God after the Holocaust? How could one possibly revive one's interest in traditional Judaism after the Holocaust? To the Jew who spoke to American Jews on the big wide world issues of race, war, poverty, dehumanization, the issues which America at large was concerned with. At a certain point, Heschel turned from inside to outside. And I put it this way. I said, Kaplan wanted to save Judaism. Heschel, I believe, at a certain point decided that it was his responsibility to save the world. I don't know what occasioned that shift. There are charitable explanations and less charitable explanations. The charitable explanation, Heschel himself said that he began to work on the prophets. He had written his German dissertation on the prophecy in Berlin in the 30s. And at a certain point, he began to translate it and to redo it into English, and it was eventually published in the late 60s as The Prophets, which I think to this day is his most seminal and important book. He says that it was when he came into contact with Isaiah and with the group of men who passionately addressed issues of war and justice and poverty many years earlier, many centuries earlier, that his question was, what would Isaiah do if he were alive today? And his answer was, Isaiah would not focus on trying to save the Jewish people. Isaiah would focus on trying to save the world, would address the issues that were roiling America at large. The less than charitable answer is that he was patently very unsatisfied with his role at the seminary. And theology was never important at the Jewish Theological Seminary, but that's what they hired him to teach. And he eventually, I think, felt that if he was to have an impact, the impact would have to be outside the walls of the seminary. And that's one of the reasons where he got... He was a timid person. And it's interesting that there are, in the book, there is an attempt to try to understand who were the people who drew Heschel out? Who were the people who got him to the Vatican? Who were the people who introduced him to Martin Luther King and tried to... Are you okay, Darun? Yes,
keep talking, I'll
try. Okay. So there were significant people that he met at the seminary who became instrumental in turning his attention to the world outside. He had an incredible impact. He had an incredible impact on that world. Wherever I lecture on Heschel, wherever I am and lecture on Heschel, there are a half a dozen nuns sitting in the first row with God in Search of Man, which is as worn as their breviary. They read God in Search of Man like I read the Psalms. And they come up to me after the lecture and they said, "You knew Rabbi Heschel. He's not..." The seminary had this very strange way of addressing people. Like Finkelstein, internally, we always called him Professor Finkelstein. Externally, he was Rabbi Finkelstein. Internally, because we were an academic institution, professor was as big as you got. But to the outside world, Finkelstein said, Rabbi is a much higher honor. So whatever it was to the outside world, it was Rabbi Finkelstein, Rabbi Heschel. We called him internally Professor Heschel, but these nuns came to me and said, "You knew Rabbi Heschel. May I touch you?" You know, it's this kind of wow, right? He had a relationship with Thomas Merton, who was the Trappist monk, and he used to go down to the Abbey in Kentucky or Virginia. Where? Gethsemane. What state is it in? Kentucky. Yes, he went down to Kentucky, and he spent days studying with Thomas Merton. And my colleague, Shaul Magid, who's now at the University of Indiana, has written about that relationship. He was the first non-Christian to be invited to be the guest professor at Union Theological Seminary across the street from us. And he taught a whole semester. He taught there. He visited monasteries all around the country. He was invited in. And when he died, the magazine America, which was published by Jesuits, devoted an entire issue to Heschel and to his impact on the church and on America and on the world. His appeal was universal. And I think one can ask, I am frequently asked of Buber, for example, what's Jewish in I and Thou? And I think it's kind of strange. Buber is basically unknown in the Jewish world. He's not taught in Jewish seminaries. I teach Buber. Gene Borowitz at HUC teaches Buber. But Buber is largely taught in departments of education, sociology, anthropology, the social sciences, religion. But Buber, for all kinds of reasons, was not very welcomed within the Jewish world. But if anybody asks Buber, what's Jewish about I and thou, his answer would be everything. I mean, the whole notion of the I-thou relationship, he says he got it out of his attempt to understand the prophets and prophecy. And in a sense, we can ask the same thing about Heschel. What was Jewish in all of this? And Heschel was much more solidly rooted in his Judaism than Buber was. One of Heschel's sources and one of Heschel's great accomplishments is to teach me, at least, to read the Bible for what it says about God. I'm going to come back to that. Not to read the Bible in the conventional way as people conventionally think about the Bible, and not to read the Bible as philosophers or as Christians read the Bible, but to read the Bible with an open eyes and to see what the Bible has to tell us about God. So his roots are solidly biblical. One of the reasons I think he was never so popular at JTS was that the JTS was a faculty of specialists. We only do Judaism at JTS. So if we only do Judaism, then we have professors of Talmud, professors of Bible, professors of Jewish history, Jewish literature, Jewish philosophy, and along comes Heschel, who teaches all of this stuff. He wrote a book on the prophets, which is Bible. He wrote a major 2-3-volume work in Hebrew on rabbinic theology. He wrote on Hasidism. He wrote extraordinarily important papers on Sadia and Maimonides in medieval philosophy. And he wrote at least 2 or 3 volumes on modern Jewish thought, which are significant contributions to 20th century Jewish theology. So he was a generalist in the faculty of specialists. And of course, all of these specialists who did only Bible would say to Heschel, why don't you stick to rabbinics? And the rabbinics would say, well, you should really stick to Bible. And the Bible people said, well, you should do philosophy. And the philosophy said, well, be fine, do philosophy. But he did all of these other things. And he did them quite well. But his appeal ranged much farther. Some years ago, I wrote a paper on what I called 3 Models of Jewish Spirituality. The title is a mistake. The paper is better than the title. The paper was an attempt to suggest that there were what I should now call 3 models of Jewish authenticity. I was trying to suggest there that there were really 3 different visions, 3 different answers to the question, 3 different Jewish answers to the question, what does God demand of me above all? And I got this idea because I was sitting in the dean's office and I had faculty coming to me and screaming about the fact that our students are not spiritual. And the students are coming to me and screaming about the fact that the faculty are not spiritual. And I said that if nobody is spiritual or everybody is spiritual, they must mean different things. And so I wrote this article and I called it the 3 Models of Spirituality, but it's not a good topic. 3 Models of Authenticity. And I suggested that there are 3 ways of being Jewish. One was I called behavioral, namely, what does God demand of me above all? Activity, doing, mitzvot. Do a lot of Jewish things, but it's external. The second model is intellectual. What does God demand of me above all? Study. The ideal was the Talmid Chacham, you know, the student who sits in the yeshiva, pale and wan, and sits from 5 in the morning till midnight studying Gemara, right? If I were a rich man, you know, that's what I would do. The third model is what I've called is the spiritualist or the pietistic model, is the chassid. What does God demand of me above all? A feeling, the heart. So I had this idea, and you can trace these in Jewish intellectual history. The behavioral model leads to the halachist. The intellectual model leads to the person who was to my Maimonides, you know, for whom study is the most important thing. And the spiritual or model or pietistic model leads to the mystic or to the chassid, who is now each of them is interested in the other two, But that's not where the energy. The energy is in one of these things. And I really believe that characterologically we are created to fit into one of those. I'm definitely not a behavioralist guy, and I'm certainly not a pietistic guy. Yeah, I do my share of mitzvot, but I don't devote much energy to it. And do I feel from time to time I have feelings? Yes. But what do I get my Jewish kicks out of? Sitting and studying and reading and teaching and writing books. You know, that's my Jewish energy. And at the end of that paper, I said, interesting question, is there any Jew who fills them all? And I said, maybe I can think of five or six. And most of them are dead. One or two of them are still living. But one of the people whom I thought of was Heschel. Because Heschel was a great scholar who was at the same time a Hasid, who ran around the world doing mitzvot. Not kashrut and Shabbat mitzvot, although he did that too, but saving the world, but doing incredibly important social and political activities and trying to do all of these things. It was a unique combination of thinking and feeling and an activity. And he integrated them. He put it all together. You never felt that one was out of sync with the other. And he needed this integration. It was very important to him. And when you think of it, how many seriously committed, observant Jews are so engaged in politics, in the war, involved in opposition to the Iraq war, let's say, in our day, in the fight for poverty, fight against poverty in Darfur, in Katrina, and how many of them went down to New Orleans and really worked on behalf of the people who were savaged because of Katrina, or in Africa because of war, or all of the terrible catastrophes. How many are deeply, seriously committed to working on behalf of racial equality? How many religious Orthodox behaviorist Jews or professors? We professors don't do these things. We save the world by sitting in our offices and writing footnotes. The incredible thing about Heschel is that he wrote footnotes, plenty of footnotes. But at the same time, he was in Selma, and he was speaking, and he was standing outside of the Danbury jail when Berrigan's came out of jail. And his office, which we saw, priests were coming in and out of the office. Black ministers were coming in and out of the office. He was deeply engaged in the political life of New York City, of New York State, working on behalf of the liberal. Remember, there was a liberal party, Olav HaShalom, in New York. He was deeply involved in working on behalf of the liberal party. He was in Washington. He was lobbying. He would sit in the cafeteria with a cup of coffee that seemed to me to have, you know, this in Greek mythology, there's this pitcher that keeps getting filled. I don't know, whatever that is. I forget the name of it. But his coffee seemed to be, cup of coffee seemed to be endlessly full. And he would sit, the tables at the seminary are tables of four. So he would come down, and three people sat next to him. The rest of us eventually got up and had to go to teach or to go to class or had a meeting or something. So different people would come in, and he could sit for 2 or 3 hours. And in the course of that 2 or 3 hours, maybe 24 people would sit next to him at the table, and he would just spin anecdotes about his conversations with Bobby Kennedy and his conversations with that or senator and his the address that he gave in Los Angeles and what was going to happen in Cambodia and what Nixon was going to do about the Middle East. I mean, he was deeply involved in all of this. And at the same time, he was writing his footnotes. And at the same time, when he came to shul, He davened with a talis over his head, and he was deeply, seriously involved as a chassid in his spiritual life as a Jew. There are very, very few people who pulled it together this way. Now, where did this come from? And I really want to suggest here that the reason I'm interested in Heschel was the theology. And I think none of this could have happened without his theology. And specifically, there are two points in his theology which I think are crucial. One was how he understood God, and the second was how he understood the religious experience. Back in Germany, he decided to write his PhD thesis on the prophets. And ostensibly, it was a strange thing to write. At the University of Berlin, he asked a question, which was a Heschelian kind of question. You know, the Hasidic Heschel used to ask these strange paradoxical questions. How come, at a certain point in history, a group of men got up and said that they were speaking in the name of God and spoke truth to the community, to kings, at great peril to their personal lives, and spoke on behalf of the poor, the widow, on behalf of justice, on behalf of peace? What made it possible for these men to stand up and to do all of this? Now, I mean, I guess you can be very cynical about this and said the whole thing was a fiction, it never happened. But we have a whole batch of literature. And although the Bible professors at JTS will tell you that the stuff that's narrated in the first five books of the Bible is fiction, none of it ever happened, everybody agrees that from about the 8th century on, from about the time of Isaiah, the history of the Jewish people, of the Israelites in the divided kingdom, Judea and the ten tribes in Israel, that historical period is more or less historically accurate. It did happen. And these men who called themselves prophets did exist. And their books are probably more or less accurate testimony of the message that they gave. And they gave that message in the name of the God of Israel. And Heschel asked this, you know, strange question. How come, what made it possible for Judaism to produce these men and that kind of message? And that became his PhD thesis. He wrote it in German. He had enormous amount of trouble getting it published because in the University of Berlin, you didn't get the degree until the dissertation was published. And he couldn't get the thing published in Germany. He sent it to Schocken, the founder of Schocken Press. The editors, the publishers of Haaretz to this day come out of that family. They were in Berlin, and then they moved to Jerusalem, and now, they have a branch here in New York. He sent it to the senior Schocken. Schocken didn't know what to make of this book, and sent it to Buber, and said to Buber, "What should I do with it? He wants me to publish it." And Buber said, "I'm not wild about it," and it was never published. Heschel's relationship with Buber never really was a very positive one. Buber left Germany in the early 30s. He had founded the Lehr House in Frankfurt and asked Heschel to take over the Lehr House after he went to Israel. And Heschel subsequently wrote to Buber in Israel, "Please, can you get me an appointment at the Hebrew University? I have to get out of Germany. We're all going to die." And nothing ever happened. So Heschel's relationship with Buber was not great. But at a certain point, the book, the manuscript, came into the hands of a German publishing house in Poland. And they published it in Leipzig in 1936. What happened to a Jewish book that was published in Poland in 1936, I leave to your imagination. All I know is that I have in my office a copy of the German dissertation as it was published by this Lehr House by this Leipzig publishing company. It became the property of the Frankfurt Lehrhaus. It has the stamp in it of the Frankfurt Lehrhaus. Somehow, it survived the war and came to our library. And I took it out of the library. I have it in my office. And I don't want to give it back to the library because the library will misplace it and it'll be lost. So I know that. And the library knows I have it, and if they want it, but how many people in this world are going to read Heschel's original version of Heschel's dissertation in German? Not many people, okay? If they want it, they have it in the computer that I have it, and let them call me, and I'll bring it to them. In the meantime, what?
So you change the lock on your door.
No, I mean, when I was a student, I used to complain about the fact that all the books we needed were the faculty offices, and they took them out and they never gave them back. But that's okay. But this book, there nobody's ever going to ask for. And in the meantime, I have it, and that's, you know, and it's labeled as a JTS library book, and I'll bring it back. If it, you know, before I die, they'll have it. They'll have it back again. In any case, it's a thin little book. That's so fascinating. The Prophets in English is in paperback, is a two-volume paperback. But in the original English edition, it's a nice, big, thick book published by JPS. And obviously, Heschel worked very hard at it and added a lot of things to it, including an individual chapter on each of the prophets, in which he tried to deal specifically with what was the individual message of Isaiah, Amos, Hosea, Micah, all of them as individuals. But the heart of the book is a translation of the heart of the dissertation, and that deals with the God of the prophets and with Heschel's notion that what the God of the prophets exhibited was what he called the divine pathos, P-A-T-H-O-S. Nobody had ever said this before. And what is it that Heschel meant? Heschel, as I said before, read the Bible on its own terms. And what he saw in the Bible was not the God of the philosophers, but a very, very different kind of God. And at a certain point, I tried to, I put it in one paragraph. To the prophet, God does not, and this is a quotation from Heschel, God does not reveal himself in an abstract absoluteness, but in a personal and intimate relation to the world. He does not simply command and expect obedience. He is also moved and affected by what happens in the world. So the term pathos is a term that is at the heart of the term sympathy, empathy, you know, pathetic. It's the same root, and it means feeling. Events and human actions arouse in him joy or sorrow, pleasure or wrath. He is not conceived as judging the world in detachment. He reacts in an intimate and subjective manner and thus determines the value of events. Man's deeds may move him, affect him, grieve him, gladden and please him. This notion that God can be intimately affected, that he possesses not merely intelligence and will, but also pathos, defines the prophetic consciousness of God. Now, this is, I think, now that he said it, is obvious. What is striking about the God of the Bible is that God wears his heart on his sleeve. God is filled with emotions and feelings. This is not a rational, detached, abstract, principle God. This is a God who cares passionately about what goes on earth. He's happy, he's angry, he's pleased. He's cared, he cares, he's engaged. He's involved. And Heschel said that only a God who cares desperately about the world would send prophets. The prophet was God's messenger. And the prophet expressed God's feelings about what was going on in society. And this notion of a God who is out there, and engaged and whose feelings are just blatantly available for everybody to see, that notion is at the heart of the biblical God. He once gave a riff in class, a riff like, you know, in jazz, riffs, you know. He went this way. He said, you know, everybody thinks that this God is all-powerful, transcendent, all-powerful, omnipotent. God gets what he wants. He says, you read the Bible carefully, God gets nothing that he wants. God is constantly frustrated. He created the world. He's happy. The first chapter of Genesis, he's happy. The world is very good. By the sixth chapter of Genesis, it's evil, and he's going to destroy the whole thing. He creates two people. Nice people, nice young people in the Garden of Eden. What do? He gives them one commandment. What do? They disobey the commandment. They have two sons, nice boys. Went to ballet, played soccer, had piano lessons. He went on like this, you know. Went to Dalton, undoubtedly, he said. And what does one do? One kills the other. One kills the other. And then he goes on. Then there's the generation of the flood. Noah. Wonderful man. He survives the flood. What does he do as soon as he survives the flood? He plants a vineyard and he gets drunk and he sleeps with his daughters. I mean, you know, what kind of a God is this? Yeah, it's all there. You know? And then he goes on, you know, and then you have the Tower of Babel, and then you have the Jewish people. He saves them from Egypt. You know, as soon as he saves them from Egypt, they build a golden calf, right? What they're complaining. He takes them out, crosses the Red Sea, takes them out of Egypt, gives them freedom. What do? They complain they don't have food to eat, they don't have water to drink, right? So what kind of a God is this? Powerful God? He gets nothing. This God is a total failure from the beginning to the end. And you know, and that has made such a powerful impression upon me. This caring God, the issues that trouble me didn't trouble Heschel. My question has always been, why did they portray God this way? Because I don't believe that Heschel really believed that God portrayed God's self this way. I mean, he clearly did not believe that God wrote the Bible or God spoke at Sinai. He was not an orthodox thinker in that sense. Would have he been happier at yeshiva? God help us, no. And he certainly wouldn't. I mean, he was miserable at HUC in Cincinnati because he couldn't get kosher food. He couldn't get a minyan. And the students didn't know any Hebrew. He was miserable at the seminary because nobody taught theology. He would not have been happy. Would he have been happy at Columbia? Probably not. So at a secular university? Probably not. But the question that fascinates me is the question that was taken up by Heschel's students, notably among them Professor Yochanan Mafs, who was a student of Heschel, who's still around, a colleague of mine at JTS. Mafs wrote a book called The Human Face of God, and they portray God in such human terms. This God is such a human being. He's a feeling, sweating, living, I would say quasi-neurotic God. He gets disappointed. He comes back, hit me again, you know, I'll give you another chance. I need your, you know, this is a needy God. This is a God who needs people. And in one of the great, I mean, you know, I tell my students about this, you know, there are 10 sentences in Heschel that if he had written nothing else, these 10 sentences would have been enough. Like, but one of these 10 sentences was that he used to say in class, God, why are you worried about widows and orphans in Jerusalem? There are more important things in the world to worry about. Worry about the United Nations. Worry about war. But you're worried about orphans and widows in Jerusalem. This doesn't befit you. You're too great a God to be worried about orphans and widows. But this God is worried about orphans and widows in Jerusalem. And that this is what... So when you ask me what made it possible for Heschel to say that we are committing a Holocaust in Vietnam. And we are responsible for this Holocaust. Was the fact that he read the prophets and saw in the prophets a God who cared about the victims of oppression, about innocent women and children who were bombed out of their hovels by the biblical equivalents of what America was doing in Vietnam. And he was absolutely, absolutely shocked by this. He could not get over the fact that we, in this country, are responsible for creating widows and orphaned children in Vietnam, that we are ignoring the victims of racial oppression in the American South, and that we are supporting a political process that maintains a divided society in which the black, the poor, the victims of oppression, the victims of war. Where did Heschel get his sense of social responsibility? It was from his God. If God cares about victims, about widows and orphans, then we should also. And victims and widows and orphans are not necessarily Jewish. There are probably very relatively few widows and orphans who are the victims of oppression, or Jewish victims of oppression. But they're all over the Far East, Southeastern Asia, and they're all over the American South. What would he have done with the Katrina experience? I just two nights ago on Charlie Rose had an interview with John Hope Franklin, who was the historian of the period of the Reconstruction, who spoke about the racial issue in America that has never been solved. That we just paper it over. And he said sometimes some things happen like Katrina, and we suddenly see the extent to which we have never really dealt with racial oppression in the United States. And my thought was Heschel immediately. That's why he went down. That's why he walked in Selma. So my question is, and this is a question he never asked, but it's a question maybe he couldn't face, namely, where did they get this image of God? Why did they portray God this way? I'll come to that at the end. So that this notion that this God, the God of the Bible, is not this abstract, transcendent, omnipotent power, but a living, feeling, sweating, human-like God who cares desperately. And if God cares, we must care also. And when Heschel said that the reason I became involved with race in Vietnam and all these other things was that I was reworking my book on the prophets, and I read Isaiah again, and I said to myself as I read Isaiah, what would Isaiah do if he were living in America today? He would be in Selma, and he would be in New Orleans, and he would be in Vietnam, and he would be with the impoverished, the poor, the oppressed. This is what the God of the Bible would have wanted. So I go back because I think it is his chapters. There are three chapters on the divine pathos in the prophets that illuminate everything else that he ever wrote. That his notion of God was not a God who was all self-absorbed and wrapped up in himself, but a God who was out there, caring, screaming, calling for attention, you know, feeling. I have a stake on what you do with my creation. This is probably what would have driven him into the whole environmental issue if he were alive today. Because the creation is part of God's creation, and God cares about the creation, so we should care about that. That's one of the two roots. The second of the two roots is his notion of the religious experience. The interesting thing about his concept of the religious experience is that this is what the student meant when she said, you know, he's not Jewish. Heschel is not Jewish, and he's not. Because Heschel's notion of the religion, of our experience of God, is that it is pre-Jewish. It is pre-symbolic. It is a universal human experience. He said it is pre-conceptual, pre-symbolic, pre-community. It occurs to every person before Judaism comes into play. He says the only people who really appreciate God's presence are people who approach God as a toddler would. As a toddler, you give a toddler a rubber ducky and the toddler's eyes go wide open. This rubber ducky is the most amazing little creature in the world. Of course, you up the ante because then he gets used to the rubber ducky, and then you have to give him something more eventually. You give him a laptop and an iPod. But at a certain point, you know, the rubber ducky is a source of what he called radical amazement. Radical amazement is for Heschel how we must confront the world if we want to see God in the world. To the religious man, Heschel wrote, this is one of his great sentences, a grain of sand is a drama. Now, a grain of sand is not a drama. But it is a drama, because in a sense, when you, if you look at the grain of sand, you wonder, how come there is a grain of sand? Another one of Heschel's great statements, the amazement at the fact that there are facts in the first place. Why is there anything instead of nothing? That, Heschel said, is the most amazing thing of all. Now, if that is where we encounter God, not at the end of a long argument, but at the beginning. In other words, if God doesn't come into your life at the beginning, when you're still a toddler, when you look at the world like a toddler, then forget about it. He's never going to come in at the end. So what we have to do is, in a sense, we have to go back. We have to reverse all of our ways of thinking about God and try to recapture the most primitive stance that we have toward the world. And that primitive stance is a human faculty. It's not the end of religion, it's prior to religion, which is why he spoke to non-Jews. Because this momentary, evanescent, ineffable, totally subjective experience, which is where we encounter God, not as mature, sophisticated scientists, but at the very beginning. He says we can do our science and we can do, you know, he used to talk about the fact that the guy came to, the chassid came to a pole and looked at a trolley car and said, how does this trolley car work? And the guy said, well, it works this way. And he gave him a whole long, complicated explanation of what makes the trolley car run. And the chassid shakes his head and says, that's wonderful. But tell me, how does the trolley car work? And I use that example with a neurology. You ask a neurologist, tell me about the brain, right? And I can get a whole semester's work of a lecture on the brain. And at the end, is my knowledge assuaged? No. Because, yeah, now I know how the brain works. And now I say, wow. So how does the brain work, right? And it's this kind of thing that the more you know, the less you know, and the more wonderful it all is. And then you revert back to the toddler stage, and you look at the world where the grain of sand is a drama. So these are the two central theological points. And if I say that Heschel was able to unite the internal and the external, the theology and social action, it's because his theology gave him two precious insights. One is that he has faith in a God who cares deeply about what goes on earth. And two, his notion of how this God is to be encountered precedes any formal religious structure. It is the most primitive thing we have. Primitive, not in the sense of that it's silly or superficial, primitive in the sense that it goes back to our basic, most human stance toward the world. We have moments of insight. And then, again, one of the great Heschelisms, faith is faithfulness to the moment of insight. You may have 2, 3, 4 experiences of radical amazement in your lifetime, but faith is faithfulness to what you once understood. And all of religion is an attempt to treasure, to store up, to create moments. That's what the Sabbath is. He wrote the Sabbath. The Sabbath is an attempt to create a structure whereby these moments can happen. And when these moments happen, you need the rituals, the community, the liturgies, the theology to enable you to hold on to those moments during the periods when it's a desert, when you experience nothing, when there's no wonder, when there's no amazement, when the world is dry and gray and every day. So it's these two theological, typical classical Heschelian notions, God as pathos and the religious experience as dealing or as emerging at our most primitive human moments, which is what makes Heschel, I think, when possible, Heschel's sense that the whole world is our is the scene of our responsibility. Now, finally, I am not a Heschelian. I've decided. If you force me to choose, I am not a Reconstructionist, though I've been accused of that. I think I am a Kaplanian. My approach to doing theology is much more a reflection of my other teacher, of my Tuesday morning teacher, than my Monday morning. It's interesting because it was Heschel that brought me to the seminary. I had no Jewish background, but I heard Heschel lecture when I was at McGill, at Hillel, and I believed that, you know, I was a generation of Jews. I was not from the generation of rabbinical students who came to JTS because of Kaplan. That was the generation of the 30s and the 40s. I came in 54. I was a post-Holocaust Jew. I didn't understand how anyone could be a religious Jew after the war. And certainly the Kaplan that I read was totally unsatisfying to me. But the fact that Heschel was at the seminary made it possible for me to say that this is really where I feel I want to study. And to this day, my sense is that nobody is more insightful. I quote Heschel more than I quote anybody else. I have my 10, 15 Heschelisms, you know, a grain of sand is a drama. Faith is faithfulness to the moment of insight. You know, as a report about Revelation, the Bible itself is a midrash. God, you should be concerned. Why are you concerned with widows and orphans in Jerusalem? Right? You should be concerned with the more important things, with the United Nations and all of that stuff and politics. I quote Heschel more than I quote anybody else. But methodologically, my approach to religion, because I ask questions that Heschel never answered. Why did they portray God this way? I believe that when our ancestors wrote about God, they looked in the mirror. That's the only way I can explain why God has got this human, this living, feeling, sweating, what I've called the neurotic characteristics of the biblical God. Why didn't he just give up? Why didn't he say, the hell with you guys, you know, I'll create another world or something, or I'll choose another people or something. But he never gives up, you know. And this is so typically, classically, a pattern of ambiguity. It's the ambiguity of the biblical image of God that makes this God very exciting to me. And I use the term vulnerability. And it's interesting that this is my term for the biblical God. I've looked everywhere in Heschel, hoping that he would have used that term, but he doesn't. And my sense has always been that anybody who cares as much as this biblical God cares becomes vulnerable to the one you care for. And I got that experience out of being a parent, right? Only your children whom you care for have the capacity to hurt you, right? That much, right? And it's the people that you care about make you vulnerable, right? You can be hurt. And this is the biblical God. He is hurt constantly, and his being hurt is an expression of his concern, of his pathos. And as much as he threatens, I'm going to throw you out, I'm going to begin all over again, he never does. I had wished that Heschel would have developed this notion more thoroughly, but, you know, you have to be thankful for what you've got. You've got to be thankful. I mean, sometimes you have to leave something for your students to do, right? And maybe that's what he left for us to do. He never really attacked as seriously as he should have the theological implications of the Holocaust. For Heschel, the Holocaust was human failure, not God's. He basically never explains how it is possible to continue to believe in God after the Holocaust. That's why I think that the one, if there is anybody who has inherited the Heschel mantle after Heschel's death, who has this range of concerns and who can speak to the whole world in the way that Heschel did in his day, it is Elie Wiesel. And I think that only Wiesel can do it, because I think Wiesel is the only one who really, in a way, appreciated the theological impact of the Holocaust. Heschel, I don't think, ever really did as thoroughly as he should have. But I guess we have to be thankful for what we got. Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions? I'm going to repeat your question.
Thank you so very much. It was very informative. You spoke of the God of the prophets, but of course, as we know, Harold Bloom's Yahweh, the name, sacred names. There are many gods in the Tanakh, and you choose your own, and I guess everybody does choose that God which they want to believe in. But then you have the God of blood, thirsty God. You have the God of vengeance, the God of Holocaust, too. So you choose your own God, I guess, yeah. As we all do, do we?
I think what's striking, I mean, my own work on this whole stuff about God is that wherever you go in the Bible, you get a different God. It's a different, I would say, it's a different face of God. You see, I guess I'm not sure I would like to pursue this with you, but it's very important for me to emphasize the fact that I see them as different faces of one God. Campbell's, you know, the hero with many faces. I think there are different metaphors, different pictures of the one God. It's important to me that there should be only one, because I always remember, I've quoted, you've heard me say this, my late grandmother used to say, Neil, never work for partners. And I said, why not? She said, because if you work for partners, it's never clear whom you have to please. I think it's extremely important that there should be only one God. Because if there is more than one God, then there is no unity. I read the new biography of Einstein by Walter Isaacson. I was struck by how powerfully religious a man he was, and what made him crazy, his sense that Der Alte, he called him Der Alte, the old man. The old man doesn't play dice, right? There's got to be one ultimate order. And he never was able to discover it, and he died frustrated. But I'm convinced that the idea of one God is important, not as a statement about God, but as a statement about us. And I think our ancestors were very wise in insisting that there can only be one God, because if there's more than one God, then there's chaos. They rejected dualism. They knew dualism. Isaiah says, I create light and I create darkness. I create tov and I create ra. I create the good and I create evil. Ani Adonai oseh kol ela. I am Adonai, I do it all. I would much rather believe in a God who's responsible for the chaos than to believe that there are two gods, one who does the orders, the good stuff, and one who does the bad stuff, because then the world is not unified. And I share Einstein's need to believe that there is one, ultimately one grand plan, which we may never discover. Although after the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva gets working later this year, maybe we will discover one unified field theory.
The question is the idea of Tikkun Olam.
We didn't invent Tikkun. Tikkun is a rabbinic Talmudic notion. The rabbis made certain decisions mishum Tikkun HaOlam. For example, the notion that although in a seventh year cycle, debts are supposed to be, they created a legal fiction in order to make it possible for people to continue to lend money, mishum tikkun ha'olam, because it's important that people should continue to lend money, all right? So, the rabbis talked about social, legislating for a better social order. The mystics took it their own direction. They believed that when God created the world, the vessel shattered, and we do mitzvot in order to reshape the vessels and to bring redemption to the world. So Tikkun has a long, noble idea, and it's not only social action. I don't know that Heschel ever used the term tikkun. I think it postdated him. It became a big in word later on. And I think that people like Peter Geffen, Michael Lerner, the Tikkun magazine people, in a sense the Heschel school, the BJ school, have picked up this aspect of Heschel and have imposed on Heschel the notion that what he stood for was tikkun. But it's not a phrase that he used. At least I never heard him use the phrase, and I have not found it in his writings. But the people who are his successors and who do the social action stuff much, much more seriously than I do, and I grant them that. And as I said, it's not my bag. I do my own things, but I'm grateful for the fact that there are Jews who take these social and political activities very seriously, and they call it tikkun, and that's fine. But and then they say that they are following in Heschel's, which they are, except that the term was not his. At least I haven't found it. I could be wrong.
The question is, does one have to be a liberal to be Heschelian?
Leftist was
or
the
leftist.
Term. Liberal is fine. Thank you for that. One of the things that there's a whole series of questions that I would love. He died very suddenly. He had a major coronary. He had sort of recuperated from that. He took a year off, but then he got all involved in the work again. The Wednesday before he died, he was up at the Danbury jail. It was a December night. It was cold and rainy and windy. It was 6 o'clock in the morning, and they drove him up to Danbury because the Barricans were getting out of jail, and there was a big Today, the Today Show was going to have a big thing, and he spoke there. And then, I don't know, you know, post hoc is not necessarily propter hoc. I'm aware of that. But the two events followed each other. You know, I'm not sure that he ever spoke out on the issue of abortion. He did not have to face the issue of stem cell research. He did not have to face... He did not have to face the gay issue. Susanna Heschel insists that he had told her that he hoped that she would eventually enter a rabbinical school, but he was not around when we eventually took the vote on the admission of women to rabbinical school. That was, he died in 72, this was in 83, 84. So, and the issue was just beginning to emerge when he died. He did not have to face the issue of the gay, lesbian, rabbinical students. These are incredibly complicated social and moral issues. And I understand perfectly well, I mean, that there are some, you know, Jewish more neoconservative voices in the Jewish community who take very committed, serious and committed stances on some of these issues, which are not, which Heschel never had to deal with. Where would he have been today? It's not fair to say. I am not even willing to assume. I mean, I assume that Susanna Heschel, who heard her father say to her that he hoped one day she would be a rabbinical student, nevertheless, I'm assuming that that's true, that he did say that to her. What position he would have taken had he been on the faculty and asked to vote on it in 83 and 84, I'm not sure. The only thing I can say is that the issues in which he did take very strong voices were positions on the liberal wing of the political spectrum, and that I should also say that he was bitterly disappointed because he felt deserted by many of his close students and acolytes at JTS, who, after the open admissions issue and when words began to come out of Washington that Washington expected the Jewish community to support the Vietnam effort at the risk of losing Washington's support for the State of Israel, and that was the beginning of the emergence of a substantially Jewish neoconservative voice among some of his closest friends at JTS: Wolf Kelman, Seymour Siegel, Will Herberg. Began to write for Buckley and for the National Review, and many of the younger members of the JTS community abandoned Heschel on the war because of their, I mean, if you go back to the open admissions thing, the Jewish community was all riled up about that because the notion was that the Latino community is going to take over City College and young poor Jews are never going to be able to get into this was a way to get Jews out of City University. And so there was a lot of, it was the Buckley campaign for senator, if you recall, in those days. But Heschel felt abandoned, and in his very, very last months felt particularly depressed at the fact that he felt that the Jewish community was turning conservative on all of these issues. And there were two or three of us at JTS who continued to uphold the liberal position and the supported the Heschelian voice on these issues. But many of his strongest supporters abandoned him. And he felt that, and he felt particularly depressed and distressed. And that was the mood, that was his mood when he died. I don't want to say that, you know, led to his death, but the weeks prior to his death, he was profoundly depressed and distressed at what was happening to the Jewish community on these issues. And so it doesn't have to be, but Heschel's voice was a liberal voice.
Thank you very much. Before we go, I'd like to thank Dr. Gilman and also Professor Gilman, and thank Doron Ruskay, who is
Gilman.
Rabbi Gilman, I'm sorry, and Doron Ruskay, whose idea it was that we have our first podcast ever for Emmanuel Reed. So you may, those of you who ask questions may be able to download yourselves. Thank you. Good night.